It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The UW system wants to reopen campuses this fall. We'll take a look at their plan to bring students back safely amid the COVID-19 pandemic and how the virus has affected operations. First, the protests following the killing of George Floyd in police custody last month have the country talking about how to move forward toward a more racially just society. One piece of that movement has focused on Confederate monuments and other symbols. In Richmond, Virginia, protesters have torn down statues of Confederate President Jefferson Davis and Christopher Columbus and covered a 60-foot memorial to Robert E. Lee with anti-racist messages. The city's mayor and Virginia's governor say they plan to remove more of the monuments. Demonstrators or local governments have also brought down statues in Kentucky, Alabama, Indiana, and elsewhere. Also last week, NASCAR banned the display of the Confederate flag at its events. The sport had been reluctant to make that move in the past, but said the flag runs contrary to its commitment to create a welcoming environment. Has a lot of people wondering if the tide has turned against Confederate symbols. Christine Emba is an opinion columnist and editor at the Washington Post. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been on with us before talking about Confederate monuments, and we seem to have had this pattern over the years. Some kind of incident, often of racist violence happens. We talk about the monuments. There's pushback. They stay. Does it feel different this time, the reaction you're seeing?
You're totally right in describing that pattern. But yes, there is something that seems to feel different about this moment, not just about the question of monuments, Confederate or otherwise, being discussed in the public square, but also the general national mood around how the general public is feeling about these monuments, the George Floyd protests, and the feelings they've engendered about conversations about racism and systemic inequality. There seems to be a much broader tolerance, polling is showing, for Americans being willing to accept that there are problems with race in this country and accept that there need to be solutions. So I think that's different from the feeling in the past. And I think that broader feeling will trickle down to the monument situation.
I think there will be arguments and debates over why this is happening now for years and decades to come. But do you have some thoughts on why this time, why 2020, why the George Floyd murder, this is happening now?
Yeah, this is a discussion that I've been having with friends and colleagues myself as recently as 10 minutes ago. I think there are a mixture of factors. One is the sort of overarching circumstance, really since the election of President Donald Trump. Many would say that he has, you know, sort of emboldened a new and more public form of, if not outright racism, intolerance, created something of a climate of bigotry. And there has been more openness to that discussion and pushback against that feeling. And then in this particular moment, you know, we are experiencing the coronavirus pandemic. People are at home and they are looking at their screens. They're watching the news. There's frankly not that much else to do. And so when incidents crop up, when the George Floyd video was made public, everybody watched it. It was hard to avoid seeing it. And so that made it part of the national conversation in a much bigger way, I think, than previous incidents have been before, simply because everybody was at home and could see it and had time to think about it, in large part, I think, due to this pandemic. But there's also, you know, demographic shifts. There have been larger discussions about inequality and racism and these topics over the past several years. But this confluence of kind of unusual factors seems to have primed people to get active, made them, if not angrier, at least more open and ready for change.
We're talking to Christine Emba, opinion columnist and editor at the Washington Post, talking about the changing conversation over race in the United States and symbols, including Confederate monuments and flags. Turning back to those monuments now, it seems like there's some pushback now to removing monuments, but it seems like there's not as much as there has been. Again, the time we talked in the past after the Charleston church shooting, the Charlottesville car attack, there's less pushback. Do you think that this talk about race right now is making us rethink what these Confederate symbols mean?
I think so. I mean, in the past, you know, as we've discussed before, the pushback has often been, you know, while they're history, we can't erase history. You don't want us to forget the past. And recent events have, you know, I think shown us that nobody has forgotten the past. And in fact, the past and the inequity, discrimination, racism that some of these symbols represent is still living with us very closely. And right now, the conversation seems to have turned to, okay, we know that this is happening. We know that racism is still with us. We don't now need to further memorialize it. Instead of, you know, continuing to keep it in a place of respect, we are changing from, you know, respecting the negative aspects of our past to, you know, wanting to recontextualize them, wanting to put them in their proper place, as it were.
And I've talked to some historians in the past about this issue, and they point out, you know, the statues, say a statue of Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee, didn't just magically congeal out of history. A lot of these happened at a particular point in American history, 1910s, 1920s. They were put there with a specific historical intent by a specific group of people. Do we talk enough about where these memorials came from in the first place?
You know, we really don't, but I think that that conversation is happening more and more right now. I'm actually from Richmond, Virginia, and I was, in fact, in Richmond this weekend, and it's famous for its Monument Avenue, which is a long, beautiful street decorated with enormous monuments of Confederate generals. And many of those monuments, like many of the ones across the American South, and in fact, across America, as you said, were not put in place directly after the Civil War to remember fallen veterans, but were installed by groups like the Daughters of the Confederacy to sort of reify the lost cause narrative that the Civil War was a just enterprise and these were good Christian men, and also placed in public space to cement a social order, to say that these areas putting up these statues had rejected Reconstruction after the Civil War and that they were firmly in support of Jim Crow, and to note that by celebrating Confederate generals and slaveholders, that the spaces denoted a white space only, you know, that this was who was in charge of these areas. And so we have to think about that when we talk about them, about Confederate statues, Confederate flags being about remembering history. The Civil War was 4 years long. There is much more history in this country than that. Why we're choosing to celebrate this particular moment in time and what it stands for often had a much deeper and uglier meaning.
I want to check out a couple of our listener comments from the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brandy on Facebook writes about the statues. They can go. We'll still learn about them, but they shouldn't be honored. And can you talk about that, you know, the role of these statues? Are they educating us about our history, or are they honoring these particular figures?
Well, it really depends. And this is what both protesters and historians are talking about and in some cases arguing about right now. Some would say that they do profess to show history, but I would say that actually they are in fact celebrations. You know, they're monuments, monuments meant to memorialize people. You know, the monuments are larger than we are often. We're looking up at these figures. And they're usually not presented with much context apart from, you know, say Jefferson Davis was an excellent general, which, Jefferson Davis was the president of the Confederacy, or Stonewall Jackson was an excellent general. First of all, both of those things are not necessarily true. And second of all, that obscures the larger history surrounding those, a history of slavery, a history of what the Civil War was actually about, and as we just discussed, why these particular statues were put into place. It's not clear whether they are, you know, learning experiences, whether they are giving a full picture of the history, or if they're something else.
We also heard from John on Facebook who writes, Jefferson and Washington held slaves. If they're taking down symbols of oppression, why not them as well? And that's a common argument. Once you start taking down statues, do we need to revisit other historical figures?
You know, that's a common argument, but I find it to be a little bit disingenuous because there is a fairly clear answer. When we talk about the Confederate flag or statues of Confederate generals and Confederate slaveholders, say, the reason why, you know, Jefferson Davis is famous is because he was the president of the Confederacy, an insurrectionist movement that split away from the United States. That is the main thing that he is known for. That is his historical significance. On the contrary, George Washington was, you know, the president of the United States and did many other things that he is far more famous for. If we talk about which parts of history, which parts of these individuals' history, I think there's a pretty clear line between celebrating, you know, someone who acted treasonously against the United States, that is the main thing that they're known for, and an American president, someone who contributed many other things to the Union and the country that we have right now.
We're talking to Christine Emba, opinion columnist at The Washington Post, also opinion editor there, talking about the removal of Confederate monuments we've seen in some states over just the last couple of weeks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we've reached a turning point on the issue of whether Confederate symbols and statues should stay or go? If so, why do you think the debate feels different now? What would you like to see maybe in place of monuments? So what would be a better way to educate us about our history? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk with Christine Emba of The Washington Post, looking at the actions of protesters and local governments to take down Confederate monuments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the tide has turned against keeping these symbols up? Are you glad or not to see that change? NASCAR banning the Confederate battle flag at its events. What do you think of that idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Oshkosh. Mike, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Mike?
Well, everyone talks about the Confederates standing for, you know, freedom in themselves and everything like that. But what really all the conflicts come down to is love or hate. Every conflict in this world, in this reality, in this history comes down to love or hate. So if you want to defend the loser of a battle over hate and love, in which love won, then you are defending hate. And therefore, you're battling against love. It's that simple.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Mike saying, if you're defending the Confederacy, you're on the wrong side of history, Christine.
Something close to that, and I think he makes a point that gels with one that I've heard made very justifiably about Confederate flags and Confederate memorials. Many say that they're, you know, celebrating Confederate history or the bravery of the Civil War, or that, in fact, the Civil War was fought for states' rights, and that needs to be respected. But they always tend to leave off the idea, the second part of that sentence, that the Civil War was fought for states' rights to own African people as slaves. And I'm not sure that's the sort of history, actually, that we need to continue to memorialize and celebrate. If that's the history that you're most invested in, fighting for the right to own other human beings, maybe you are on the wrong side of history.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike, at 800-642-1234. I want to turn to NASCAR now, Christine. We saw some years back NASCAR sort of politely requested that people not bring the Confederate flag to their events. Some fans did not honor that request. Now, last week, they say they are banning it at all events and properties. Did that surprise you?
You know, it did surprise me somewhat because, as you said, there was a soft request that they tried a few years ago that was summarily ignored. And NASCAR is, you know, often seen as a sport of the South. It's extremely common at NASCAR games to see a profusion of Confederate flags flying in the stars and bars. But at the same time, you know, this is a moment in which many, many companies, corporations, individuals are, you know, revisiting their commitment against racism and actually what they think their customer base wants and should be. And NASCAR is a very popular sport. I mean, there are many, you know, black and minority fans of NASCAR. And in this moment, you know, to make them comfortable coming to races, to show that, you know, they are a sport for all people, it makes sense that they would take this stand.
We are talking to Christine Emba, opinion columnist and editor at The Washington Post, looking at the decision to take down Confederate monuments in some communities around the country and remove the Confederate battle flag from the public sphere in some cases. I want to talk a little bit about putting context around some memorials. Christine, we talked a little bit about Thomas Jefferson earlier. I was at his memorial in D.C. a few years back. And they have, you know, information about the Declaration of Independence and his role in that, the American Revolution, his role in that. And they have a display on Thomas Jefferson as a slave owner and the contradictions with the ideals he brought up. We can talk about both in some cases, right?
Yes, absolutely. And especially with people like Thomas Jefferson, for whom there really were, you know, in some senses, two distinct sides to his presence on the American scene. Someone who did hold slaves, but someone who also, you know, professed many of the truths that we still hold dear in the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. It's important to be able to see both sides of the person and both sides of our history in order to understand how we got to where we are today. But to see both sides have to be presented. You can't just have a statue that just has a name under it and nothing else. You have to make an effort to make sure that all of the information is there and clear, and that one side is not given more purchase than the other.
With the monument debate and the action to remove these, do you see this as a significant part of addressing issues of racial inequality, or do you worry that it becomes kind of a sideshow and maybe distracting from some more immediate issues?
You know, yes and no. I mean, taking down a Confederate monument in a town square does not necessarily put legislation into place that, you know, helps reduce racial segregation in housing or schools. However, I do think that for the people who live in these communities, people, African-American people who, you know, have spent their lives walking under and looking up at a statue of a man or the flag of a country that would have enslaved them, that declared them to be less than human and less than an American citizen, having those public squares changed does say something about where we are today, does enable a feeling of participation for those communities, does seem to level the playing field at least a little bit, if only psychologically. Symbols matter to human beings, and you know, having a symbol that would draw you into the earth taken away does something.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us in Ladysmith. Tony, hi.
Hi. I just want to bring up some history with Germany. I don't think you see any monuments of Hitler and his Nazis, but you do see monuments of all of the people who were in the concentration camps. I think we really should start looking at some history. And as far as the ones that were put up in the 1900s and the 1920s, that was to promote the idea of blacks are less than humans. And they had lots of lynchings and everything else going on. And that was sort of to intimidate the blacks.
Tony, thanks a lot for the call. Tony, pointing toward Germany as an example of how they remember, obviously, a dark stage in their history, Christine.
Right. I mean, Tony made a great point, actually. Germany obviously has a very dark history, but, you know, they can remember that history without having statues of Hitler standing around. In fact, in the city of Berlin, one prominent kind of memorial is the Stolperstein, or stumbling stone. There are not monuments to Hitler, but instead there are raised bricks in front of the homes of Holocaust victims that people walking around and through the city will stumble upon and stop and look at. This remembers the victims and still keeps them alive in the city's memory, rather than memorializing the villains of history.
Thanks a lot for that call. And I know, at least in some cases, there have been efforts. I think there was an effort a while back for a national slave memorial that didn't come to pass. I think it ended up kind of converting into the National Museum of African American History and Culture. But do we need to see monuments to slaves, freed slaves, escaped slaves, things like that?
I mean, I think that would actually be nice and an improvement, because You know, if you want to remember history, you do want to remember all of the parts of history. You want to remember the heroes and the successes of other groups, too. When you look at our education system, when you look at what's taught in elementary schools and middle schools, so much of what is taught is, in some ways, the history of, if not the victors of the Civil War, at least the side of a certain philosophy of the Civil War. But I think that what many populations, Black people in the United States, minorities, would like to see their stories elevated, to see themselves and their communities also celebrated as heroes of the American story. Again, as I was saying, that symbolism makes a difference. So why not, you know, have a statue of Ida B. Wells or Harriet Tubman? Both of them have certainly done more for the United States as it stands today than Jefferson Davis did.
In our last minute or so, Christine, there's a lot of movement right now. Do you think that this is going to be an ongoing thing, or do you think it's going to fizzle with our short attention spans?
I mean, this question has been ongoing for the past several years, and I think it has gained momentum in this current crisis. And I don't think that that momentum is going to be rolled back. The George Floyd protests took place in 50 states and even 18 countries. Even in the UK, in Belgium, in South Africa, the debates about who to celebrate, which statues to keep up, and who to memorialize have spilled out from our shores. You know, statues feel permanent, but they are not. And protesters have already begun to take this question into their own hands. I don't think this is going to be stopped very easily.
Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Christine Emba, opinion columnist and editor at The Washington Post. She was with us today to talk about Confederate monuments and symbols coming down around the country and why the long-running debate may be at a turning point. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the UW System's plans to reopen campuses this fall while still taking precautions against the spread of COVID-19. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a 1910 automobile blue book described Wisconsin as, quote, a real paradise for the automobile tourist. We'll dig into the history of popular tourist attractions over the years with an expert from the Wisconsin Historical Society. First, the University of Wisconsin System says it wants to get students back on campus this fall amid the coronavirus pandemic. Over the weekend, the UW System released a set of safety guidelines for the universities and branch colleges. They involve social distancing, limiting in-person class sizes, prioritizing certain courses, and more. Those recommendations come after some UW institutions released their own plans, some more detailed than others. The UW System said it expects to lose $212 million through summer because of COVID-19. Rich Kramer is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
I am Wisconsin Public Radio.
You are. In so many ways, Rich, you really are. Well, tell us, Rich, it wasn't that long ago, just a few months when classes were moved to online only. What have UW System officials said to make the case that, yeah, we ought to be back in business in person in the fall?
Well, I mean, the transition in March to all online within a matter of weeks, like 1 or 2 weeks, was really jarring for everybody. I mean, on social media, I saw a lot of students complaining about it, you know, and professors really had to work quick to really change their entire lesson plans. And that's no small task. So, you know, that worked for the spring semester, and in the summer, the campuses were closed too. But all the while, we've been hearing from administrators and from students that they just want to go back to, they want in-person learning as much as possible. So what the we have heard UW System President Cross say that that was the goal, but what officially dropped on Sunday was kind of the system's recommendations to the campuses. It will be up to the chancellors and their administrations on the individual campuses for how to implement these, but the UW System guidelines just throw out some suggestions based on the science that they've looked up. Some of the notable examples are they're recommending that any classes with more than 50 people are moved online, and that some classes that can't really be taught online, think of like chemistry lab or you know, other sorts of classes where you really need that hands-on, the UW system is recommending that those be given priority when it comes to available class sizes, because if you're going to do social distancing, you just can't have the same number of people in classes. So what we're seeing from some of the campuses, like UW-Eau Claire is talking about using its student center, which has a lot of big ballrooms, to hold classes in there. I mean, they're really trying to think of all options to make sure that there is an in-person experience, which is beneficial, which is preferential to online, but to do it, you know, with every safety measure that they can think of in place.
And that's the classrooms, and that's just part of the story. There's also things like dorms or residence halls and the cafeterias and things like that. Did they give recommendations for those?
Absolutely. So one of the things that caught my eye was the recommendations from the UW system include a suggestion. Again, it's just a suggestion, but that campuses save 5% of their dorm rooms for quarantine and isolation. You know, if students get sick, they got to be able to go somewhere, especially if they're living on campus. So that was notable. But I talked to a health, he's a retired epidemiologist with UW-Madison, who now is a consultant and on a COVID-19 task force for the National College Health Organization or Association. And he said the dorm rooms are really the wild card, and that's what he's most concerned with, because in the classroom, it's more regulated. You know, you can have your practices, you have someone to kind of put them in place, but when you're dealing with a dorm room floor and a bigger campus like UW-Madison, where maybe 30 different people are using the same restroom facilities, he stopped short of saying it's a recipe for disaster, but he did say he's very nervous about that. And also just because, you know, there's not going to be someone there to police these recommendations at all times in the dorm rooms.
We're talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer about the UW system and how it is looking at going back into in-person action this fall. Guidelines from the system for all schools, but then the local schools will make the ultimate decisions over what they actually do when fall rolls around. This isn't a lot of time to kind of reinvent the way in-person stuff is going to happen, Rich. Do you get a sense that they feel like they're having to scramble to put changes into place?
Well, that's a great word to describe really what COVID-19 has done to all of higher education. It's been a scramble from the beginning. And this person with the National College Health Group said that really all these recommendations and everything like this is kind of a best informed guest, because he said we've never had to try to bring students back in the midst of a pandemic. So I asked overall, you know, is it safe? And that's kind of an unanswerable question. And also, why are we doing it now? If we just told students to leave campus, what's the difference? Well, he said that the difference is now we've got the testing capacity. He also, you know, he basically said now the hospitals are able to deal with any influxes in cases if they happen. So they're working very quickly, but they have been working on this with the universities. You know, the system has been working with the universities. Universities are working with local health departments. They've been working on this since classes were shut down, basically. So they're just going full speed ahead, and there's some really high stakes for financially speaking for universities, because you cited the $212 million figure. A big chunk of that was refunds that were given to students for housing and dining services. And personally, I had no idea that that was such a big revenue source for, you know, the UW system, but really all of higher education. And that just evaporated. So the big question that I have is whether, if they have to go back to, you know, telling students to stay home, if they, you know, what kind of financial situation would that put UW system and campuses in?
You mentioned testing there, Rich. Are there plans in place to test some, more, or all students?
They're working on that. So what happened is, like last month, during a Board of Regents meeting, UW System President Cross said that he wanted testing to be, you know, for all students to have access to testing, all employees. This plan it gives some recommendations on testing, but it seems like now they're more gearing it towards people that get sick. But it doesn't have any specific, you know, this many tests per campus. That's really going to be up to the universities themselves. And that's a huge order because it's expensive. And it seems like the capacity, you know, for testing equipment and the things that are needed to conduct, to process the samples, the supply chain has seemed to catch up for the most part, but still, it's just going to be a lot of work that has to happen very quickly.
Another random element here, Rich, you mentioned UW System President Ray Cross. He is looking to get out. The only candidate still in the running to replace him in this hiring process, dropped out last week. So where are they now in trying to replace Ray Cross?
That's a big TBD, to be determined. I reached out this morning to the UW System Administration Office, the communications people, and asked if President Cross is still planning on retiring, because he was going to leave soon after they had picked a new person. And that really looked like Jim Johnson of the University of Alaska System had a lock on it. But at the morning that the search committee was going to recommend him, or was likely to, he said, no thanks. So I don't know yet. I don't know yet if it's going to be President Cross. I don't know if there's going to be an interim appointed, which they do with chancellors, but that wasn't really brought up as a possibility in this current search process. So it's unknown.
You and I can brush off the old resumes, Rich, and give it a shot maybe. As we wrap up, Rich, people are looking to the federal government potentially for another round of coronavirus-related relief. I know some universities around the country are lobbying for that. Is that something we're hearing here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. The UW system has advocated for more emergency funding for students in the form of grants, but also for institutions. The last round, I forget what it is, but so that $212 million in losses across all of the UW, all the state-owned institutions, I think the total amount of federal funding from the previous stimulus bill was something like $50 million or less for all of the institutions. So it didn't even touch the losses. They're lobbying for that. There's also some universities and some higher education groups that are lobbying for liability protections to try to shield the higher education institutions from being sued throughout this process. And there's been some action on they call it the HEROES Act, but it hasn't passed yet. So, and it's totally unclear whether it will at all.
Rich, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter in Eau Claire. We talked to him about the UW system's plan to reopen campuses this fall amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. Coming up, Wisconsin Dells is still a big tourist attraction for our state, but it's been a point of interest since the 1800s. We'll talk about the history of tourism in the state and how much or how little it's changed. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll find out how to be a good listener and why so many people feel that no one really listens to them. First, a lot of us have our favorite spots to visit during a Wisconsin summer, whether it's a certain lake in the north or a visit to the Wisconsin Dells with the kids. We might think of them as our spots, but it turns out that some of these places have been attracting tourists for a couple centuries now. Joe Kapler is lead curator in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Division of Museums and Historic Sites. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Good afternoon. Thanks very much.
Well, when I think of Wisconsin tourism today, I might think of the Dells or lakes in northern Wisconsin, Door County. Historically, in the early days of Wisconsin, were these some of the first tourist sites to emerge in the state?
They certainly were. 1837, you could say, was kind of the first intentional effort to meet the needs of visitors and tourists. The opening of in Wisconsin Dells of a inn and tavern specifically for visitors and travelers. But it's really the 1850s in Wisconsin, both say in the Dells, even the Geneva Lake area and Door County, where tourism as we think of it today really got its roots started.
And the draw, the initial draw for a lot of these places, no surprise, it seems like it was natural beauty. Was that the general trend there?
I think you can thank your favorite glaciation period for that. Absolutely. The Dells carved out by a catastrophic breach in the ice dam from a glaciation period, like or Geneva Lake carved out by a previous glaciation period, and of course the Door Peninsula carved out as well as all of those beautiful lakes up north in Lake Country, in Vilas County, Forest County, that area specifically. So water being the key thread in all of those areas.
Now, if it's the 1850s and I'm a would-be Wisconsin tourist, how did I get to all these places? I couldn't hop in the car, and there wasn't a road I could have driven a car on if it existed.
And there's a couple of options for you. By 1850s, you could think steamship or think boat, I should say, along Great Lakes to get perhaps take you all the way up and around to the maybe even the Ashland area, the Door Peninsula, and embark from there. 1856, the railroad reached what was Kilbourne City, or what we now know today as Wisconsin Dells. So that was big. So you could see who could get to those places, and it wasn't the common jump in the car that we think of today. So even though tourism started at that point, a relatively small amount of people with time and means to afford those long transit routes. And then this wasn't a leave work on a Friday and get home on Sunday night thing. This was people that had weeks to take off to vacation.
And how did word get out about these scenic sites? There were no internet ads or TV ads. There was no GPS to help find them. How did people, say, in Chicago or Milwaukee find out about these things?
1856, the Wisconsin Mirror, the editor included a very famous, what's now a very kind of famous and oft-quoted statement, the wild romantic scenery of the Dells will always make them a place of resort for seekers of pleasure. That was in 1856. And in the Dells area, they are advertising in newspapers in Chicago. So again, a very intentional effort. And later on, steamship companies in the 1870s, as the railroad is reaching places like Geneva Lake and further up north and further inland, the railroad organizations, booster associations, kind of both governmental and businesses getting together, promoting in Milwaukee and Chicago, especially. And, of course, we can't forget our own Henry Hamilton Bennett of Wisconsin Dells, incredible imagery. And that really put the Dells on the map, because all over the country, people can say their area is gorgeous and beautiful and natural splendor, but Bennett's stunning photography and the publication of it coast to coast really solidified the Dells of Wisconsin as a not only a national scale, but a world-class destination.
Talking to Joe Kapler, lead curator in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Division of Museums and Historic Sites, looking at the history of tourism here in Wisconsin, how our most famous tourist sites came to be way earlier than I would have thought. Let's fast forward a few decades, Joe, to the rise of the automobile. What kind of game changer was that for places like the Dells and the Lakes and Door County and so on?
Probably the biggest game changer. 1920s, automobiles are becoming accessible to more and more people. And the grand attempt to make up north, the cutover region and farmland, you know, failed. Not good soil and growing season, apparently, for up there. But while all these wonderful lakes, the remaining forests and the forest regenerating appealed to so many. So roads are booming, not the interstates that we're thinking of today. That's 50s and 60s, but even in the 1920s. So an explosion in volume. I think in 1922, the ferry at Sturgeon Bay, July 4th, had like 2,200 cars, I think, or something like that. My numbers are probably a little bit off. 5 years later, Memorial Day weekend, 35,000 people crossing. So, you know, that's a massive increase. The same with up north. And so it also, you know, it brought family visitors. It shortened up the time. You didn't have to pack your trunks and stay for weeks. It could, the automobile allowed you and me and your neighbors and friends and family to take much shorter trips and get much further into these lakes that are tucked away further and deeper into the forests.
And did I read, I think it was on the Historical Society website, before the amenities developed, people would just drive along and they'd just camp in somebody's farm field or something like that, which did not make them popular initially with the locals.
They're auto camps alongside the roads and initially, you know, free and, you know, well-intentioned, pitch a tent, have some latrines there, that type of a thing, but a victim of their own success. Really tough on county budgets. And, you know, in the 1920s, you really start to see the issue, kind of the tug and pull of competing interests and the managing the impact of large-scale visitation. So you start to see visitors coming in and leaving and maybe not having a huge impact on the positive side of the tax base, but drawing resources. And you really start to see it there. And then, you know, taxes on hotel rooms and things like that to account for it. And it brought to light the issue of whose resources are these and who gets to benefit the most. And not specifically a Wisconsin story, but a major story here, given the enormous natural resources that we have. And so much of our state is amenable for visitation and tourists. And there's always been the back and forth and the tug and pull and the adjustment to visitation.
So this, a lot of the things we think of as standbys in tourism, the places and later the amenities, a lot of them are still there in modern form. What do you see as the biggest change since the early days of tourism in Wisconsin to 2020?
Water is always going to be the draw. And I've lived in six Midwestern states, and it's not the same elsewhere, that is for sure. You know, the water and the certainly the summer climate is world class, and it always will be. The biggest difference here today in 2020, you might come for the water, and I hope that you see a lake, and I hope you dip your toes in the water. But the so many other services, entertainment options for you. Great, you know, eating and drinking, all of those opportunities are there for you 24/7 in many places, and also, you know, year-round in many places as well. Really catering, full service. So if there's a dip somewhere in the economy with family visitation, well, you still might have sports camps, or you still have the summer camps, or you have, you know, the business retreats and all of that. So the tourism base has really widened its stance and is on, you know, firmer ground, so to speak. And I think that's, you know, the major change between now and a long time ago. But the reason is we're a beautiful state, and that will always be a draw.
Joe, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It's good to talk with you.
That's Joe Kapler, lead curator in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Division of Museums and Historic Sites. He joined us for a look at the history of tourism in Wisconsin. Well, do you have a memory of the kind of tourism you did it back in the old days? Maybe not 1837, where we started our conversation, but, you know, 20, 30, 40 years back. Let us know. Email us ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us some memories at Central Time WPR. We just heard about some inspiring nature photography from the 1800s. Well, today, by the way, is Nature Photography Day, created by the North American Nature Photography Association. It's a good time of year for some great photos of the natural world here in the state. I can't really celebrate because I'm strangely terrible at taking good pictures of nature or of anything, but Central Time producer Bill Martins is a real good photographer. Hey, Bill.
I want to see these supposedly awful pictures of yours. You talk them down all the time.
They're not uniquely awful. They're just really boring. I'm a very mediocre photographer, but consistent. But you, I think, Bill, have some advice for me and people like me on taking better nature shots. What can we do?
I would say the first thing, just get out there. Get out there a lot, even if it's just in your backyard, taking pictures of stuff, because as they say, you know, practice makes perfect. I also like to look at other people's photos. Just go online and you can get some ideas for composition and stuff from there. And also try different angles. I see a lot of people, they just go out there and they have the camera right at eye level. I say get down on the ground and look up or take it from the side, you know, something unexpected. Those are three really simple things you can do right off the bat that I think will help you out.
And if I do that, I'm going to take awesome pictures, even better than yours. You promise
me. That's all you have to do. That's the secret.
Awesome. That's Bill Martin, Central Time producer and real good photographer. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.